And good morning, West Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. Time for Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Thanks for joining us today. Green Bay Packer legendary linebacker Dave Robinson is with us. He was recently inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And along with another Packer great of the glory era, Bob Long, and sports guy Royce Boyles, will take the stage of the Heidi Center next Friday, the 17th. It's called Green and Gold Legends. It's film and it's noise and it's conversation and your questions, so you can forget about last Sunday's loss. Jim Oliver is here today with Erica Janik, a WPR producer, also an author of books on history we don't usually get elsewhere. Eric Johnson calls in from UW River Falls to tell us about his trip to Hollywood as part of an Academy of Television Arts and Sciences seminar and what insights he can now convey to stars of tomorrow. And let's shove off on this voluminous voyage with this. A while back, a news release arrived from Jerry Poling, Assistant Director of University Communications at UW-Stout. The headline read, Professor Praises FDA Plan to Ban Trans Fat Has Questions. The professor is Carrie Peterson of the Food and Nutrition Department. When I read that she had questions, I had questions. Spectrum West is about the culture of West Wisconsin and certain things, that's right, affect our culture, health being one of them. So, with that connection, Carrie Peterson and I embarked on some dialogue about food, nutrition, and about health. Tell me about the history of trans fat. I mean, I'm guessing that years ago people would look at a label and trans fat wasn't on it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they've actually been around for quite a while. Their use in commercial food products accelerated from about the 1960s through the 80s. Mm-hmm. And then in the late 1990s, we start hearing that maybe these types of fats aren't the best for our health. But just to note, what the FDA is proposing is that we remove partially hydrogenated oils from their generally recognized as safe list. Mm-hmm. So partially hydrogenated oils are the primary source of trans fats in the diet. And trans fats are the fats that are the worst for our health, heart health. They raise our LDL cholesterol or the bad cholesterol, and therefore they have a really negative impact on incidence of heart disease.
Why do we hydrogenate things?
We hydrogenate oils because it improves their shelf stability. So food manufacturers, when they add hydrogens to liquid plant oils, that makes those oils more solid. Therefore, they can stand the shelf a longer period of time. Foods don't go rancid. They improve the stability of flavors in foods as well.
Mm-hmm.
We find these types of oils and these types of fats in highly processed food items. So the types of foods that we really go towards when we are in a time crunch, you know, easily prepackaged foods that we can open and we can eat right then and there. So I think that's why we saw increased use in commercial foods, in the 1970s and 80s, when we started really working a lot more. Then in the late 1990s, that's when we really start hearing that maybe these types of fats aren't good for our heart health. And at this time, I think it was in about 1999, this is when the FDA first proposed that food manufacturers be required to add trans fats to labels.
Mm-hmm.
So trans fats are even worse for raising your LDL cholesterol than saturated fats. And saturated fats is what we have typically heard about in the past as being not so healthy for your heart.
Sure.
Trans fats are so bad for our heart health that there's no established safe intake. So the Institute of Medicine actually recommends that you limit the intake of these fats as much as possible.
Okay. Now, we've also all heard the stories of how years ago our grandparents and great-grandparents ate lard sandwiches.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they were just fine because mm-hmm. they worked hard. So mm-hmm. are we just pinning it on trans fat, or do we have a lifestyle problem as well?
I think it's a bit of both. I think we definitely have a lifestyle problem. And, you know, we can take all of these foods and we can tweak them to make them healthier. But when it gets right down to it, you just have to eat sensibly and go back to basics, perhaps. You know, focus on fruits and vegetables. Focus on getting enough physical activity. And no matter what is in these snacky-type foods, just limit those foods. Trans fats were originally added to foods in response to concerns about increased saturated fat intake.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, we took out one negative type of fat, and we just ended up replacing it with another negative type of fat. At the time, we didn't know that trans fats were going to be really unhealthy, but over time, we've seen increased incidence in heart disease and positive correlations between intake of trans fats and heart disease.
Yeah.
So I think that's the question of, okay, if we take this trans fat out of the food, what are we going to add to foods so that foods still are shelf-stable and they still taste like consumers think they're going to taste?
On the phone with us, Carrie Peterson. She's an associate professor in the Food and Nutrition Department at UW Stout. Our general focus is trans fat as it's being phased out by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. You know, Carrie, food manufacturers are good at keeping things from us. What happens, I've noticed lately, is that, they talk about the fact that they keep their prices the same, they haven't raised their prices, and yet the packaging is getting smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So can trans fats and things like that be hidden? Is there a way that trans fats in some form can be still injected into food?
Well, yes, because you can't actually taste the trans fat.
Mm-hmm.
And if the amount of trans fat in a food product is less than 0.5 grams per serving,
uh-huh,
on that nutrition label, a food company can put that the food product contains 0 grams of trans fat.
Uh-huh.
So what you have to do to be a smart consumer is look at the ingredients list. And if that ingredients list contains the term partially hydrogenated oil, that is your indication that the food contains trans fats. You'll see partially hydrogenated palm oil, partially
sure,
hydrogenated soybean oil, but you will see the terms partially hydrogenated.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about the Food and Nutrition Department at Stout. Students who study food and nutrition eventually do what?
Well, we have a variety of programs here. We have an undergraduate program in dietetics,
mm-hmm,
and those students are being prepared to become registered dietitians, and a registered dietitian can work in a variety of locations, from hospitals to food companies, private practice, long-term care facilities. We also have a food science and technology program,
mm-hmm,
and those are the students who are going to be out in the food companies reformulating foods to make them healthier,
sure,
and meet consumer demands.
Young people, they've always been notorious for eating unhealthy. I would guess that people involved in the food and nutrition department at Stout eat better than others. How's the current generation of young people doing in the eating healthy department?
I think they're becoming more aware of nutrition issues. The problem that we're finding is people don't know how to cook anymore. And so if you want to be eating fresher foods and decreasing your intake of processed foods, you have to know how to prepare those foods. So I think if we can be teaching students earlier on in life how to prepare simple, healthy meals, we'll see a huge change in their ability to cook for themselves and their decrease in processed food intake.
Yeah, and most of that knowledge and ability came from mom,
mm-hmm,
or grandma, who used to say, hey, come on, put an apron on. Let's make this pie together. I've also read lately that home economics seems to be coming back a little bit.
It does, absolutely. More emphasis on going back to the basics and learning how to cook, learning how to prepare your foods, learning that French fries actually come from potatoes, and they don't just come from the freezer aisle in the grocery store. I think we need to be teaching kids about the sources of food and getting kids out into the garden, taking them on farm tours, teaching them how food is grown, and then allowing them to pick their own food, make their own food, and then taste it so they can understand that, wow, fresh food tastes really good, and I don't need to go to those processed foods.
Well, let's just hope that the sensation of tasting those kinds of foods and the satisfaction of doing what you just suggested overrides the convenience factor and the iPhones, because it does take time to do those things.
It does take time, and I think it takes time up front, planning time, but once you learn how to do it and it just becomes your way of life, it doesn't take as much time as people perceive.
Mm-hmm. Any other trends underway or anticipated in your world? I mean, technology is touching everything. What's exciting in your biz?
I think technology is touching everything. We're seeing a lot more apps for helping you eat healthier and making healthier changes, apps that allow you to go into a grocery store and scan a food item. and, you know, incorporate it into your daily meal plan. But I think we will be seeing more trends on going back to the basics, more farm-to-table emphasis on local foods, emphasis on farmer markets, and just eating less processed foods and focusing more on fruits and vegetables, moderate intake, balancing your plate. I tell my students this all the time. If there was an easy answer, Oprah Winfrey would have figured it out. She would have told all of us. And so the challenge here is to figure out how can you do the best you can do in the context of your daily crazy life? Mm-hmm. How can you make those healthy choices when you have all of this other stuff going on that is preventing you from making healthy choices? Sure. And when you can figure that out on your personal level, I think you've got it. The hard part is the consequences don't show up until later on in life, right? That's chronic disease. It develops slowly and over time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I eat a really high sodium meal today, I'm not going to feel my blood pressure go up. But if I do that over and over and over again, you know, when I'm older and I'm 60 and I'm 70, I might be on blood pressure medications. Yep. So it's difficult to communicate that message to, you know, a younger individual when you're not experiencing the consequences right then and there. Mm-hmm. But I think if we're consistent with the message, you know, they're seeing parents and grandparents on medications and they're thinking to themselves, I don't want to be like that one day. I think there's hope, and I think they are listening. You have to put your health up on number one of the priority list. It has to become important to you as an individual so that the barriers to making the changes are outweighed by the benefit.
Wonderful message. Carrie Peterson, keep up that great work at Stout. Thanks so much for being with us here on Spectrum West.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
There you go. More important realization that leads to innovation at all our marvelous universities of Wisconsin. Several right in our West Wisconsin neighborhood. This is Spectrum West. We appreciate you joining us today.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering full real estate services from listing to selling properties. Current listings, mortgage calculator, and other information is online at wisconsinrealty.org.
Here's a Spectrum memo for you. Just came in the mail. Northern Lakes Center for the Arts presents a student art exhibit, the opening of an exhibit featuring a display of student artwork from the Amory Public Schools. That exhibit will extend through January 31st. The opening event is Friday evening, the 10th of January, 7:30 p.m. Northern Lakes Center for the Arts is in Amory, of course. Well, each week, Jim Oliver stops by to share a conversation he's had, mostly with people involved in the production of a play or musical on any level and in many Western Wisconsin settings. He also loves to read, so he grabs a literary assignment now and again. This week, Jim is doing the now and again thing about a unique book, actually from one of our own.
Erica Jonick is the producer and editor of the Wisconsin Public Radio series, Wisconsin Life. She is the author of four award-winning history books, and her work has appeared in such publications as Smithsonian, Mental Floss, and Midwest Living. Her latest book, Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine, was released this past Tuesday. Erica Jonick joins us by telephone from Madison. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, on your website, you are described as a writer, historian, inveterate seeker, curious about everything, especially history, and passionate about writing. So, to shorten the story a little, what led you from an educational path to be a history professor to being a researcher and writer and also into broadcasting?
I mean, I really loved history. I've loved history since I was in elementary school. And, you know, I did think that I wanted to be a history professor, but then I was realizing as I was in graduate school and working on my master's thesis that I really liked doing kind of public history. I liked writing things for people who didn't think that they liked history, who didn't think history was very interesting. And so that really kind of set me on this path. I finished my master's degree, and then I decided that I still wanted to do history, but I wanted to do a different kind of history. I really just wanted to tell the kind of quirky, fun stories that I loved as a kid, and I wanted to tell them to other people.
By the way, you were originally from Washington, as I recall. What led you to Wisconsin?
Graduate school. I came out here to do the women's history program at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and I'm still here.
What led to your interest in 19th century medical practices?
It all began actually with an article that my husband, who is a physician, he had sent me something from the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it was this article kind of commending the state of Wisconsin for finally catching these two quack doctors, these brothers in Milwaukee. They were named the Reinhardt brothers, and they ran a fake medical business there. People would write to them with all kinds of problems, and they would diagnose you, no matter what, with a sexual dysfunction. Hmm. And I got really curious about who these guys were, and looking more into the story. The Reinhardt brothers were a really fun story, but they were exactly the story that I kind of expected, which is that, you know, that there were these quacks out there in the world who were trying to bilk people. But the more I started reading about 19th century medicine and what was actually going on, it got a little bit muddy for me. It didn't seem that black and white story that I thought I knew. I started finding, you know, people that were practicing kind of alternative therapies that, you know, we're still kind of practicing today. People that were advocating that we need to drink water, that we need to exercise. You know, these are things that I do all the time. And these are coming, you know, this recommendation is coming from people that are labeled quacks. And then the other thing I think that really excited me about the 19th century and this medical history was finding out how many women were actively involved in this field of medicine. You know, I'd always assumed that, you know, women couldn't be doctors. And that was largely the case. Most mainstream medical schools did not allow women to practice. They didn't allow them to enroll in the school. But I find all of these alternative fields that are really welcoming to women, would love to have women be involved. And so women could actually take leadership roles and be doctors. And I just thought that was really fantastic and really interesting.
You know, that's an interesting point you bring up about women participating in the practice of medicine. I grew up in a farm, and my mother, who was a child during the early parts of the last century, always talked about how her mother and her grandmother, they were the ones who treated the kids when they were ill. They couldn't just run down to urgent care when there was somebody had a fever. They had to treat the kids themselves. I was wondering how much of that was the case in the 19th century when women were practicing medicine, much as housewives and mothers and grandmothers were practicing medicine in their own families.
That's really been the case really since colonial days. Women have always been kind of the nurse, the doctor, the pharmacist for their families. Particularly in colonial America, there really weren't a lot of doctors, and we live in a really big country. And so people were really spread out, and so there often wasn't a doctor that was accessible. And for much of our history, even till today, you know, medicine is expensive. And so a lot of people found it a lot easier to just treat themselves. So that idea, you know, that we know of, that marketing term of Dr. Mom. Women have been Dr. Mom for centuries, long before marketers ever invented that term. It was really just these alternative medicine groups in the 19th century that were allowing women to be professional doctors.
Well, I believe I counted 46 pages of notes and bibliography in the back of the book. So how long did it take to research and write this book?
Oh, really long time. It took me about 3 years of research. I really love the research process. I find it really exciting, and it's actually something I have to stop myself from going overboard, because at some point you do have to stop researching and start writing. So I did spend about 3 years just kind of reading and trying to figure out what story exactly I wanted to tell, and seeing what sources were out there. And then the book was, it really changed a lot as I read more. You know, I went into it thinking I was going to be telling one story, and I just kept finding more sources and more books and letters that kind of led me in a different direction. And I think that's one of the really fun parts about doing history, is that you really never know what you're going to find.
She is Erica Jonick, who is the author of the book Marketplace of the Marvelous: The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine, which was released this past Tuesday. Now, talk a little bit about some of the medical practices of the past that are still in use today.
There are some of these 19th century remedies where it wasn't necessarily the way that they were using them or thinking about them is the way we still think about them today, but it led us in the right direction. So if we think about something like phrenology, which was the practice of reading the bumps on your head. Now, people thought that, you know, they could feel your skull and that that would give you an accurate map of your character and your personality, based on the idea that your brain was broken into parts responsible for different functions. The fact that you can read your character on your skull is inaccurate, but the idea that your brain has specialized parts that kind of link to certain characteristics, certain functions, That's exactly right on. You know, that's something that really led us in the direction of understanding how our brains work. And water, as I already mentioned, hydropathy was a medical field that was based all around the healing benefits of cold, pure water. And they did all kinds of rather odd things with water because they believed that, you know, if you drank water, it would help wash the disease out of your body. And so people would bathe, they would wrap themselves in wet bandages, they would take all kinds of showers, and this was all cold water. And so it wasn't really very pleasant. But they really actively promoted the idea of preventative health and that drinking water was good for you and that you should drink as much water as you can. And so that idea of drinking 8 glasses of water a day is real vestige of these hydropaths in the 19th century. They also promoted things like eating fruits and vegetables and whole grains and having a lot of fiber in your diet. And this was actually very common among many of these 19th century healers, that they really were emphasizing preventative health. And so a lot of the things that we do now, you know, doctors are always telling us to eat more fruits and vegetables and to drink water and to exercise regularly. You know, these were exactly what these 19th century healers were telling their patients to.
You mentioned the doctors in Milwaukee who were literally quacks. So why did people buy into the outlandish claims? Some were called snake oil remedies. Were there were actually snake oil products on the market. Are there still such things that exist?
There were actually at the time things that were literally made out of snake oil, but that, you know, kind of became a general term for all kinds of patent medicines in the 19th century. But the reason that people went to them is because they wanted to be well. Medical knowledge in the 19th century was very limited. We didn't know anything about bacteria or germs. We didn't really understand how people caught diseases. Things were not sanitary by any means. People really had nothing much to go on that was scientifically based. And so healers that could come up with, you know, a pretty convincing story of what was happening in your body and offer a remedy of a way to fix it became very popular because all of us want to be well, and none of us like to be told by our doctors that, you know, they don't know what's going on. We want answers. And so that's really what drives people to go to these healers. That's what drove them to those healers in the past and what drives them to those healers today.
Now, you talk about some other professions, medical professions, I guess, chiropractic, osteopathy, that still exist today.
They do, yeah. You know, so some of these things are, you know, it's not just the practices that they did that still exist today. The field itself actually exists today. So osteopathy began, it's very different today than what it began as. It was really just about manual manipulation of your spinal area. And today, osteopaths are, you know, often working side by side with mainstream doctors, and this manual manipulation is usually just a small part of what they do, if they do it at all anymore. Chiropractors, though, are pretty much doing what they were originally doing in the 19th century, and they kind of remain on the fringes of kind of accepted medicine, whereas osteopaths have really kind of forged a place for themselves within the kind of accepted mainstream medicine.
Being a good, loyal Ideas Network program, we need to, of course, talk about Wisconsin Life, in which you are producer and editor, and we need to talk about it a little bit. Wisconsin Life is broadcast at 6:30 and 8:35 a.m. on Wednesdays and Fridays during morning edition, and at 4:45 p.m. Monday and Wednesday during Central Time on the Ideas Network of WPR. So talk a little bit about the show for those who may not be able to listen or just move to town or whatever.
Yeah, so Wisconsin Life is an audio series. Right now we're actually going to be expanding into TV starting in February, which is very exciting. But we really celebrate what makes Wisconsin unique. We're looking for stories about Wisconsin people that are doing interesting things that kind of tell us what it means to be in Wisconsin, to be from Wisconsin, to live in Wisconsin. And so we've done stories on all kinds of things. We've done stories about a family that ate squirrel, would hunt for it, and then have a squirrel feast. We've done stories about brewing, of course. We've also done stories about Ho-Chunk language preservation. So really run the gamut of the types of stories we can tell about Wisconsin. We really just want to capture the diversity of this place in our stories.
What kind of difference are we going to see in Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television?
Well, it's going to be kind of an expanded version of the audio series. Obviously, we'll have visuals, the very basic thing, but it's going to be a half-hour TV program that'll be made up of about 5 or 6 stories. There are so many stories we've wanted to tell on the radio series that have a really strong visual component, and I just keep thinking as I'm doing the recording, gosh, I wish people could see this. And so I think that's one of the most exciting things that's going to happen with the TV series is that there are some of these things that are really hard to capture just with your ear. And so finally we can, you know, bring these to people with their eyes.
Getting back to Marketplace with the Marvelous for just a minute, are there any special events that you have scheduled to unveil the new book?
Well, my launch is actually on Thursday in Madison at A Room of One's Own. And I'm still working on some others. I will definitely be out all over the state, hopefully, talking about this book.
Well, it'd be nice if you'd come to Eau Claire. I mean, it does warm up here eventually.
I'll come when it is warmer.
Okay, fine. Well, we've been visiting with Erica Jonick, author of Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And thank you, James Oliver. Spectrum West for a Thursday. It's the 9th day of January. You might be also listening on the 10th on the News and Classical Music Network. We rebroadcast at 7 o'clock Friday evenings. Well, the Heidi Center presents Guys on Ice this evening, Thursday and Friday. Also Friday and Saturday evening at 7:30 and Sunday afternoon at 2. Tickets at cvca.net and by phone at 726-9000. Writers Read Open Mic will be held at the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire Tuesday evening, January 14th. Registration at 6:45. The program begins at 7. Some Spectrum memoranda there for you. The next Friday, the 17th, the Heidi Center stage in Chippewa Falls welcomes Green and Gold Legends. It involves men who were the Green Bay Packers of what's called the Glory Years. This event features a couple of those gentlemen, Bob Long, number 80, a receiver, also known as Flanker back in those days, and Dave Robinson, inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame within the class of 2013, a linebacker, number 89. I had the chance to talk with Robinson from his home in Akron, Ohio, along with Green and Gold Legends producer Royce Boyles. Robinson played college ball at Penn State when Joe Paterno was an assistant there. Dave Robinson has very pointed opinions on the Sandusky debacle, the NC2A penalties, and the restrictions and hardships placed on college athletes within programs that make hundreds of millions of dollars on the performance of those athletes. You'll hear a bit of that, but Friday the 17th, you'll get a lot more about everything, including what you want to know, because you'll be able to ask questions. We begin with Dave Robinson talking about Penn State. Do you stay close to Penn State over the years, have you?
Fairly close. They kind of drove a wedge between they and I when they tried to kill Joe, but the NCAA is a good case for manslaughter, what they did to Joe Paterno. Very unfair, very unjust, everything they did. Just crazy what they did. I just sit down and give you half an hour just on how I hate the NCAA and what they've done to it. And not just the Penn State. Nothing to do with Jerry Sandusky, up to including castration, would be acceptable as far as I'm concerned. But why did you take away 110 games from a coach who on-field, when nothing that Jerry Sandusky did, affected the on-field play? Mm-hmm. I mean, if they had been paying ball players, if they've been buying guys' houses like other teams did, if they've been doing all these things that were illegal, and affected the game, then take away the win. No doubt about it. Mm-hmm. Playing another ball player, take away the win. But why do you take away 110 wins from a team who had one of the cleanest athletic programs in the nation, graduating 90% of his football players? Why would you take away 110 games? For one reason only. Joe was an arrogant guy. Evidently, he teased off a lot of people in the NCAA, and they did not want him to go down the record of being the winningest coach of all time. It took away his games so he would not be the winningest coach. That's the only reason I see for taking away the games. And the second thing is, Joe Paterno, everybody in hindsight says Joe Paterno should have seen what was going on. He should have known something. During that same period of time, 4 times, Jerry Sandusky was reviewed to get either be a foster parent or an adoptive parent. And 4 times, the so-called experts interviewed him, checked him out, and said he's okay. If the experts couldn't find anything wrong with Jerry Sandusky, how was Joe Paterno, a layperson, supposed to see what was going on. Mm-hmm. People do the horrible things that Jerry Sikorsky did are very adept at hiding it. Very, very good at keeping away from people knowing what they really were doing. I played ball with Jerry Sandusky. I never suspected Jerry Sandusky was a pedophile. Hmm. Never.
Wow. Well, Dave, it's obvious that Penn State is a can of worms for you. And
it is.
There's lots of...
It's not Penn State. It's the NCAA.
Okay.
As a sanctioning body, I think you need to be disbanded.
Okay. Okay, well, your point is well taken, and it's noted. Rice, the people listening have to know a little bit about your history. It all started in Wisconsin Rapids. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, I grew up there, and I got into television, and, you know, I admired Vince Lombardi and those teams, obviously, when they were winning. I probably liked the old Milwaukee Braves in baseball better, and then they ripped our hearts out after the 65 season and moved to Atlanta. But I was really captivated by the greatness of Vince Lombardi and his teams. I was fortunate enough to work in Green Bay in the late 60s and early 70s, and that's where I got to meet Dave and a lot of his teammates. It was just great to be able to cover and meet and get to know my heroes. And I can tell you that it's been nothing but a treat ever since with what we're doing. And I think, Al, what you can tell is Dave feels very strongly about a lot of different things. By the way, Dave and I went 32 years without seeing each other. And just supposedly, coincidentally, we were doing the same trade show at the Wisconsin High School Coaches Association, and we saw each other for the first time in 32 years. One thing led to another, and we decided to write a book. And one of the absolute fundamental rules that we had is that we were not going to retell a bunch of stories that Green Bay Packer fans knew. And that's the same way with Green and Gold Legends. And we're really privileged to have Wayne Larrabee, the voice of the Green Bay Packers, do the introduction to Green and Gold Legends. And Wayne says, our hope is that you are informed, entertained, and touched by greatness. And that's what we want. We want people to learn things and to be entertained. And, of course, Dave provides the greatness. We've pursued, and I think we've been quite successful in unearthing lots and lots of stories about the Lombardi era that were not told previously.
From what I've been able to read and photographs I've seen, it appears as if Green and Gold Legends, the format of it, is very informal. The pictures I saw were easy chairs on a stage. Is that the way you pull it off?
Yeah, very much so. That we complement our conversation with lots of graphics, lots of video, but it is informal, as you've mentioned, Al. As a matter of fact, it is so loosely structured that we have, I think, a treat for people in the Chippewa Valley in that the only man to play for Vince Lombardi in both Green Bay and Washington, Bob Long, is going to be joining us on the 17th.
That's a nice addition. Let's go back to Dave. The format is what? People in the audience ask you questions, or is that following a presentation?
Yeah, we have a presentation, then we do have a question-answering period. But the one thing I will say about easy chairs one night, I'm 72 years old. this Friday is Bart Starr's birthday. He'll be 80 years old this week.
Wow.
And 20 years ago, we could do this as stand-up.
Sure.
But yeah, we got to have this in the easy chair and sit down. I can't stand for an hour and talk. But we do try to bring out things that you can read all the football magazines you want and all the articles you want. Some of the things we talk about, you will never hear before.
You know, Dave, there's not much missing in your NFL career. I mean, I did some reading, and, you know, you had a full career, now Hall of Fame. I know there are some disappointments with the way retired NFL players are taken care of, especially when compared to other pro athletes. But
right.
I'm curious, how does Dave Robinson feel when looking back on his football career?
Well, first of all, I am disappointed that they don't take better care of the guys. And a lot of people who played football gave it all and gave up their health and everything else. And, you know, something that people don't realize, I'll tell you, when I came to the National Football League, the league was not on solid ground financially. I can't think of a single team in the league had its own stadium. Every team in the North in our division played in the baseball field. And we played half our games at Milwaukee County Stadium, a baseball field. All the teams played in baseball parks, or some played in college parks. And they all got these luxurious stadiums with these big locker rooms, everything else. And all that money is being spent, and everything is going. And they are dumping big money back into the modern ball player. And why can they sit in that big locker room? Because certain people, and I feel myself as being one of them, who paid the price to help establish that league, I think that it's time that the investment that we made in the league should pay some dividends.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I think. They're not doing it. They just ignore us. In fact, there was one very notable pro who's right now who's making $20-plus million a year that says, why should he help these guys who squandered the money with bad investments? I was a first-round draft pick and got $15,000 a year, which to raise a wife and three children on. I don't know how I could have squandered my investments for that. And we sometimes talk about that. In fact, anytime somebody asks about it, we talk about that during the Green and Gold presentation. The game is so great. If I was asked to come back and play again tomorrow and was able to, I'd play tomorrow for the same salary I got back in 1963. I love playing the league that much. I love the National Football League, and I'm ecstatic about the Green Bay Packers as a team and as an organization.
Well, that's admirable stuff there, Dave. I didn't expect to hear that.
I tried to talk about things that people didn't know. My wife died in 2007, and people didn't realize she was the first African-American wife to come to Green Bay, Wisconsin. Those days, there weren't many ballplayers on the team, and nobody brought the wife to Green Bay for a lot of reasons. She was like a pioneer. At the same year, Elijah Pitts' wife came up also. So between the two of them, they were kind of forerunners of everything. I mean, she came to Green Bay when my twin boys were 10 months old, all alone in the city. And when she first got there, the only African-American in town with two children, and she only saw her husband for 1 hour a day between the hours of 9:30 at night and 10:30 at night. The rest of the time, I had to spend out in St. Norbert at the training camp.
Hmm.
And you think that was an easy job to do for a young girl who was the only child, never had any nephews and nieces, never worked with children. Now she's got twin boys, 10 months old, and she's alone 23 hours a day. You don't know where the grocery store is, don't know where the hospitals are, don't know where the doctors are. In those days, even more important, she didn't know where the diaper service was, because we had cloth diapers back then, you know. You got to understand, and that's the things I talk about. All this talk about the downs of the situation, that if they ask me, I'll tell it. Like somebody asked me one time, what was the biggest game I ever played in? They expect me to say the Super Bowl or the Ice Bowl or something. The biggest game I played in was in 1967 when the Green Bay Packers went to New York City and we were playing the New York Giants, the number one offensive team in the league, and we were, at the same point, the number one defensive team in the league, went to Yankee Stadium. Three of my four brothers, my mother and my uncle, were there at the game. And Frank Sinatra came to the locker room, got to meet him and whatnot and everything else. To me, that was the biggest game of my career. We won the game, by the way, but not because it was such a big game, a turning point, but because it gave Vince a successful homecoming. But my family was there. The biggest game to me is when my family could get a chance to see me from New Jersey, see me play, and I had a good game.
Good for you.
Had two interceptions, a sack, and a block punt, and it was great for me.
Uh-huh.
I just loved it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you are bringing up some things that, as you said, most of us don't know. That story, Dave, about your wife coming to Green Bay, I mean, I knew of one Robinson who was a pioneer. I guess I just didn't know there were two. So congratulations on that.
And Al, if I might add this, Dave Robinson was the first black starting linebacker in the National Football League. So the Robinsons have been pioneers on several fronts. You're absolutely correct. Vince Lombardi emphasized team, and my goodness, there were so many things going on in America that could have torn a locker room apart. You know, there was the Berlin crisis, there was Vietnam, and obviously the big igniter, you know, could have been the civil rights movement in the United States. We will talk about those things. Obviously, we'll talk a lot about football and have some video clips, you know, about that. And then, of course, Bob Long. You know, I think Bob Long is one of the very, very few people who can speak authoritatively about the change that Vince Lombardi went to. You know, there's always the question, could Vince Lombardi be successful today? Bob Long can address that. And then the nice part is, when we open it up to questions, whatever the fans want to talk about.
After the Packers lost on Sunday, this gives people the opportunity to get another little injection of green and gold yet this season. Tell us about the charitable aspect of the program as well, would you?
One of Dave's great teammates, Henry Jordan, who died, unfortunately, at the tender age of 42 in 1977, Henry never drew a penny of his pension or any benefits for his family. A little over 2 years ago, his widow, Olive, developed ALS. The family was exhausted financially and mentally and psychologically. Dave and his teammates, like 24 of them, got together to help them out so Olive could have 24-hour care in her later days. That's kind of what launched this effort. We raised over $63,000. Got all of the care that she needed, paid for the funeral, and there's money left over. And if there are needy former Packers from Dave's era earlier, a bit later, we stand ready to help them.
Charitable events for Green Bay Packers and people in Wisconsin have really been the background of everything we've done. the Lord has blessed us because we try to help others.
Well, gentlemen, my time is up. This conversation was all I had hoped it would be, and then some. I know that there's a business side to what it is you're doing, but the side of it that I find most impressive is the fact that you're doing it as well because you love it. You love the game, you love the fans, you love the concept, you love the past, you love the history, the legacy, all that stuff. Thanks so much for keeping us in the loop and keeping this stuff going.
Well, thank you, Al. And where else but Wisconsin and with the Green Bay Packers could you have a Hall of Famer at these very, very affordable prices have this kind of access to people? This is absolutely meant to be from the Lombardi era.
We told you a lot today, but believe me, we held back a lot, too.
It's been a pleasure talking to you guys. Keep up the great work.
Thank you again.
Green Bay Packer linebacking great Dave Robinson and Royce Boyles, who along with another green and gold legend, Bob Long, will be at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls Friday evening the 17th, 7:30. Tickets at 726-9000 and at cbca.net. Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Knights of the Round Table will be staged by Community Arts in Fall Creek through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Steel Magnolias will play through Sunday and next Thursday through Sunday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. A dinner theater production of Guys on Ice will play through Sunday at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. The Eau Claire Children's Theater production of The Hundred Dresses will play this Friday and Saturday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. The Neillsville Area Players are hosting the Missoula Children's Theater production of The Secret Garden. Auditions are scheduled for 4 p.m. Monday at the Neillsville High School Auditorium. Performances will be at 3 and 7 p.m. Saturday, January 18th at the high school. Storytellers Kevin McMullen and Tracy Chipman will perform at 7:30 p.m. Saturday at the Erica Kwan Theater in Shell Lake. The Red Barn Theater is holding auditions for the 2014 season from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, January 16, and from 9 a.m. to noon on Saturday, January 18th in the Fine Arts Building on the campus of the University of Wisconsin, Barron County. The 53rd season of the Red Barn will open on May 28th. The season includes Don't Hug Me, I'm Pregnant, The Sunshine Boys, Footloose, Foxfire, and Sweet Surrender. The Eau Claire Children's Theater is holding auditions for Willy Wonka at 5:30 p.m. Sunday and Monday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver. Spectrum West, thanks for being with us today. In September, we talked with Eric Johnson about the impressive digital film and TV program at UW River Falls. At that time, we inquired about his appointment as a seminar fellow in the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. The appointment entailed, as you might guess, a seminar among those who regularly produce television programming in Hollywood. That seminar has come and gone. Eric Johnson has gone and returned, so we were curious about how it all went. In reading a list of things you did, I recognized some names like Jerry Weintraub, Stargate Productions, Parenthood, Warner Brothers, CSI, Disney, and more. Let's hear about what kinds of life-changing things happened to you.
Yeah, absolutely. The seminar, this was the 26th annual, so they've been doing it for a while, but basically it's designed to give a glimpse into the behind-the-scenes world of television. And the life-changing part was just the opportunity to meet these folks firsthand and have a chance for some real candid discussions, and also to see firsthand some of the inner workings of things that prior to this I had only seen on the television screen. Some of those names that you mentioned were just a few that I experienced during the week. Everything from the business side of television, which of course it plays a huge role. There was a fellow that I met there that had kind of an interesting Midwest connection. His name was Rob Schwartz. He explained the direct connection. Businesses are a part of the programming decisions in terms of finding an audience and finding a return on that. But you mentioned Jerry Weintraub, probably one of the most high-profile people I was able to meet. He has a long-standing history in the entertainment business, but had a real interesting story with his connection with the music business and how that correlated with the world of television, his connection with Elvis Presley. We also took some real interesting tours. Stargate Studios was the production company that we toured, and they are concerned with visual effects. So there's some contemporary shows that are very popular called, like, The Walking Dead that use a lot of special effects. It was just real neat to see the behind-the-scenes workings of how those types of ideas take shape, and also how they're able to work basically around the clock and around the world with different locations that, once they start a project, can be shared internationally and you know, really proficient in their turnaround. It's still very time-consuming, but when they clock out at 6-7 o'clock, then they turn it over to somebody working in another part of the world, and those people can pick up where the others left off.
Some of us have all been led behind the cameras, but you really got behind the cameras and into the bowels of the production end. Is that kind of what you were able to do?
Yeah, absolutely. With Hollywood especially, they're very concerned about their public image and oftentimes have a controlled way of imparting those details to the public. Well, we had a little bit different access point in terms of, you know, we're all from the academic world, and you know, it wasn't open to the public, so we were able to ask questions and dig a little deeper than, you know, just a canned type of response that most folks are used to seeing. We had a couple of attorneys come in, experienced with securing rights and what's legal and what isn't, and also in addition to just, you know, the average TV consumer, they put it in a perspective that college students and budding filmmakers could appreciate as well. And that's one thing that I took away from it that I've already shared with many of my students and use in classes that I'm going to teach in the future.
On the phone with us, Eric Johnson, Assistant Professor of Digital Film and TV at UW River Falls, had the chance to go out west and meet some of the big people behind the scenes in Hollywood. Eric, you know, you strike me as a very curious person. Did you have some things prepared, knowing what you were going to see, or was it all just spontaneous curiosity for you?
I had a combination. I would say as soon as I found out that I was a recipient of this program, I reached out to some prior recipients. It's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. You know, once you apply for it and are accepted, then that's it. You can never do it again. And this was the first time somebody from the University of Wisconsin River Falls had ever received it. So anyway, I reached out to some prior recipients to see if they would have any words of advice of how I could get the most out of this, knowing that it would be a once-in-a-lifetime thing. A professor from UW-Madison got back to me and said that I would enjoy it, which I certainly did, but if any words of advice she would give would have to be with making connections. And I took it upon myself to get some business cards, so I was able to, you know, meet people, introduce myself, make some connections. And in terms of the questions that I came up with, I did have some things in mind ahead of time. And one thing I've learned just in general, if you have something that you can find in common with somebody, oftentimes that leads to the person imparting more detail. So, you know, as an example, that Rob Schwartz, who was from the Midwest originally, and, you know, it turns out his grandmother was from River Falls. And anyway, you know, I was able to ask him some more information beyond what he just, you know, used in his presentation. Same with Jerry Weintraub, although Jerry Weintraub, I'd heard another interview with him on NPR and also on some of these talk shows and read some of his books. And I asked him about the Elvis Presley thing. I said, you know, there's got to be more, you know, juicy stories. And a lot of these things were taped and they'll be available online in the future. And Jerry was very aware. He said, now the cameras are rolling, so I'm not able to tell everything. But he did tell one real interesting story about his tour with Elvis when it first started out. It took him $1 million to convince Colonel Parker, which is Elvis Presley's manager, to make this happen, which back in the 50s was, you know, a lot of money.
A lot of
money. Anyway, Elvis's only demand was that every show be sold out. The tour was in Florida, and they decided to do a matinee show. Weintraub went there the day before and found out that 5,000 tickets were still unsold, and it was a panic moment. So apparently, according to him, he went to the local prison, paid off the warden for the prisoners to come over. And I was thinking, okay, this is going to be like a Johnny Cash, Folsom Prison type of thing. But it turned out the prisoners took out 5,000 seats, piled them into the parking lot, put a tarp over them, and then the matinee show went off without a hitch. Elvis was very happy, and then they put them back as soon as it was done, and that was precedent setting after that. So anyway, that was a little story that I hadn't heard before. But in addition to that, there's just so many other things that were inspirational and helping me open my eyes to details and things that I hadn't thought about before.
Yeah, and I can see where this kind of involvement would give you much more fodder for being just a more involved educator. I mean, you have, as I read, a renewed sense of purpose in your role as educator.
One of the interesting aspects of this whole experience with the Academy was the reason they do this, and it's at their expense. I had very few things that I had to pay for, and it was the red carpet treatment all around. And the reason that they do this is to create ambassadors. They really feel that from an academic perspective, we're the ones teaching this and imparting this knowledge and inspiring these future filmmakers to go on and pursue their dreams like many before them had done.
Yeah.
And that's one other thing that I'd like to comment on that was very remarkable to me is the fact that there are very many people that I met there that started from meager beginnings. And I'd been aware of like the internship program, and I'm a huge internship proponent, having been an intern and an internship coordinator myself. But many of the interns that had started with the Academy are now at the top of their fields. And that's one thing that when I came back, I was very adamant about encouraging my students to say, look, you know, your chances of this are just as good as anyone else.
You bet. To the young people, don't be afraid to take big steps, because when you do, you'll find that there are footprints of those who took them before you.
Absolutely.
Well, Eric, thanks so much. I appreciate you taking more time with us. And as things develop and as your students get famous, be sure to keep us in the loop here at Spectrum West, would you please?
That's one thing that I told the students. The only thing you have to promise me is that once you make it big in Hollywood, you have to come back and be a guest speaker in my class.
Yeah, that's mandatory. Thanks so much. Happy New Year.
Thank you, and same to you. I appreciate it.
Eric Johnson, one of the many prototypical educators at the University of Wisconsin-River Falls, with a connection now to Tinseltown. Wow. Spectrum Memo, the Menominee Singers present When Mother Nature Sleeps, We Sleep, Dream, Pray, and Hope. Nathan Jacobson, conductor, Robert Schuller, poet. Friday evening, 7:30 at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee, and Sunday afternoon at 4 at St. Joseph's Catholic Church. Also, auditions for Gold Town Showdown, a new musical comedy, will be held Monday, the 13th, 7 p.m. at the Heidi Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. Rehearsals are in February and March. Performances will be at the end of March. It's a Jerry Way original, so it should be a lot of fun. Thanks, Tiffany Coggins. Thanks, Jim Oliver. Thanks to you guys for being out there as the reason we do this weekly hour of music, arts, and West Wisconsin culture. We'll do it again next week, 10 a.m. Thursday morning, with talk about trails with benches, kind of unique benches. Writers and authors gather in Amory. Sue West has a new CD and more. I'm Al Ross. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next week. Have a great weekend.